You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 110. The world has changed since our last episode just 2 weeks ago. Today, we're going to talk about how a couple of local New Orleans business people are working to help the city respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. But before we get into that, a bunch of you have asked on Facebook and through messages, so I thought I'd give you a quick update on us. I am working from home and trying to coordinate my day job and the 200 employees and their families and trying to make sure they're doing okay and also serving the people that we serve. My family is all home, so we are now homeschooling twin 8-year-olds. Those of you that have kids know what that's like. I'm trying to run a business and homeschool. It's been a little bit interesting. The podcast, so many of you have asked, and it's important to me that we keep going and we keep sharing New Orleans with you, even though obviously for right now, everything is different. My sponsors have all taken a break, and I think that's the right thing to do so they can preserve their resources and take care of their employees. But as soon as they can come back, I look forward to having you get out to the old number 77 Hotel in Chandlery. Work with Liz Wood over at Liz Wood Realty when you're ready to move to New Orleans and take a Two Chicks walking tour, not far from your neighborhood right there, Jess, as we'll talk about in a minute, over by Lula. But I really just want them to do everything they can. And in the meantime, this podcast was founded on trying to promote and support local businesses and the history and the culture of New Orleans. And so we're going to keep on doing that. And when the sponsors come back, they'll come back. So my guest today, I actually have two guests, and what drove this is twofold. I have been looking for an excuse for a long time to talk about distilling in New Orleans. Much like craft beer, I think New Orleans was late to the craft beer scene, with the exception of Abita, and similarly, I think, when it comes to distilling. And then a couple days ago when the world changed, the two gentlemen that we're going to talk to today got together and decided to see what they could do to help. And one of the ways that they were able to help is to turn a part of their operations into producing hand sanitizer. So my guests are the co-owner of 7-3 Distillery, who is Sal Bivilacqua. And also I have Jess Bourgeois from Lula Distilling and Restaurant. That's pretty unique, and we'll talk about that. So, guys, welcome so much. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having us.
And I know it's been a long day. We're at the end of a day. You guys are working hard. I want to get into what you guys are doing and how you've shifted to help the community. But first, I want to talk a little bit about both of your respective businesses. If you don't mind, Sal, we'll just kind of start with you. I know that you were born and raised in New Orleans.
Yeah, born and raised, but I always have to be careful. Because I did not go to high school in New Orleans. So I always want to qualify for our New Orleans listeners, but yes, was born here, went to school here until sixth grade. Do have a cemetery plaque going back to 1902 in St. Rock. So I think I qualify from here, but I cannot answer the question, where did you go to school correctly?
You know, some New Orleanians. I was born and raised like you. I went to Brother Martin, so I can answer the question. But I feel, and longtime listeners have heard me say this, I think that is... You are a New Orleanian if you live and do the best you can to be a part of the culture. And sometimes you're a New Orleanian even if you aren't here and you just embrace it, right? And what about you, Jess? Did you grow up here or did you grow up somewhere else?
I didn't know. So I grew up in Donisonville, Louisiana.
Yep.
Yeah. Right between here and Baton Rouge, almost smack dab between. And I went to a little Catholic school there. I went to LSU. Yeah, worked, went to culinary school after I got a food science degree from LSU. Worked at Commander's Palace for a couple years. Then went with a restaurant group to Birmingham after Katrina. My wife and I subsequently moved back, started working on this business, and and now we're right in the middle of this very strange time.
Yeah. Converting our facilities into yet another manufacturing
plant.
For sure.
Yeah. For those of you that don't know, Donaldsonville is out there in the heart of sugarcane country.
It is, yeah.
Which is a nice tie to what you both do. My wife and I took our kids not long ago on a tour of a sugar plantation, but also a a processing plant out there.
Unbelievable.
And so the kids got to go with the hard hats and go through and see from the drop-off point to the mash. Afterwards, they got to get in a combine and cut a row of sugar cane. So that was, it was pretty interesting. And, you know, obviously there's a long history there, going back into slavery and all of the problems, but it's also so interesting to see how our food comes to market. And so much of the sugar comes from that part of Louisiana that we use all over the country and all over the world. So that was pretty interesting. So you guys both, I guess we'll start, Sal, with you in 7-3. How did you decide to get into the distillery business?
Well, it kind of came to me. Ted Danson tells a story about his life kind of sitting in the back of a pickup truck looking backwards and then just arriving someplace and saying, how did I get here? I feel like a lot of my life has sort of been that way. I entered into law very similar fashion. And this project came to me through my law practice. It was a failing project, and my wife and I took it over. And before that, when I was, you know, as a lawyer seeing the issues going on, I just started researching on my own time and kind of fell in love with the whole industry because I'm a litigator and nobody can agree on anything. And I really love this industry because even though we're technically competitors, we all work really well together. And especially since day one, Jess and I have been sharing ideas and information and from day one. So it was
before,
just really
before day one. Yeah.
Yeah. Before day one. Right. Right. And I just love how everybody's so generous with one another. And I mean, I'm from New Orleans, so of course I love my alcohol. So yeah, I kind of fell into it and just found a real love and passion for it. It's certainly a passion project.
When did you guys found 7-3?
March. We opened March. Good Lord.
17.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was 2007 was coming to mind, but I knew that wasn't right. Yeah. 2017.
Yeah. And so, well, I'll ask you the question, then we can talk about it. So where does the name 7-3 come from?
So, many of us, or most of us, do not know this. And I did not know this until we were doing market research for a name. There are 73 official neighborhoods, and in the 70s, the City Planning Commission just, in some regards, just randomly divided up neighborhoods, randomly assigned names like Dixon and mm-hmm. Black Pearl, and, you know, obviously the neighborhoods have been around forever, Marinette, Treme, all that. So yes, every time I tell somebody, even lifelong, generation long people do not know that, but that's why the name. So each one of our brand or each one of our spirit lines is dedicated to a neighborhood. So St. Rock's our vodka. We have Irish Channel whiskey. We are sipping the yet unreleased, and y'all are one of the very few people that have tasted our Bywater bourbon, which we were intended to release in May or June. We'll see how that works out. So yeah, so in the back of the labels, there's a little bit of discussion about the neighborhood, how it got its name, if we know. And so it's just, we wanted to embrace the city, and what truer way to embrace the city is through its neighborhoods, because we are all very attached to our neighborhoods.
Well, and I love your branding. And when I read about 7-3, I knew it would catch people off guard, because when you go through the list, and I'll put a link to your website, certainly, but maybe also to either the city or the Wikipedia page, there's 72 or 73, and a lot of them, again, lifelong New Orleanians will argue.
Oh, yeah.
It's just in the last couple of years, you've started to see signs pop up, and you say, well, that's not, you know, that's not the name I know it as. Richard Campanella, the well-known Tulane professor and author of, I think, 10 books, has been on the show a bunch. He's done multiple things about the names, but I think it's a clever way to tie in. And then certainly you mentioned St. Rock as one, the Irish Channel. Your whole line kind of ties into that. And again, here in the distillery, you have the maps of New Orleans, and I think it's a really clever kind of twist on 504, for instance. Right,
yeah.
It's another twist on that.
Yeah, and we also have, we're in historic Treme, not the new weird Treme.
right.
And so, yeah, we even have, it's kind of the best for last. We have a Treme Alchemy, which is sort of our experimental line too. So
nice.
We just sell that currently out of the distillery.
And we should mention, we are right on Claiborne Avenue. So I'm 110 episodes in. The one I haven't done that I need to do is the history of Claiborne Avenue, because it's very different today, and it gets back to racial issues, and we have this overpass right in front of us that didn't used to be there. This was a beautiful oak-lined, business-lined street.
Exactly. I'm actually on the board of the Claiborne Merchants Association.
Okay.
So it's one of two or three associations dedicated to bringing businesses back onto the Claiborne corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the ideal thing would be for the overpass not to be there, but the next best thing is to bring businesses back from the area that were ran off and never came back. There's been some grant money, and there is a 24/7 effort to raising additional money and getting projects started. They have plans that include, open spaces for parks, shops, food, music stages. So that's a really exciting project and something I'm really happy to be a part of.
Well, maybe I'll get you to help connect me to somebody that knows the history. And we're right on the Lafitte Greenway. We are very close to Kermit's mother-in-law lounge. Of course, most of this stuff you can't enjoy right now, but somebody's going to listen to this in a couple months, and hopefully the world's back to normal, and they can. I want to get to Jess, but one thing I want to mention, I mentioned to you offline. So we are right on Claiborne Avenue, and about a baseball's throw away on the river side of the street, just a block down, my family used to own a place called Bologna Brothers Wine Bottling. So you guys both are probably familiar with Bologna's liquor distributorship out of Baton Rouge. That was one branch of the family. But they actually had a private wine label, and they would ship in by railroad car raw wine, raw grapes from California. And they would bottle right there almost across the street.
Yeah, so we have our Italian heritage similar. And our claim to fame was before Tipitina's was Tipitina's. There was actually a Bevilacqua bar there.
That's cool.
So long history in roots in alcohol.
So for listeners, Tipitina's on the corner of Napoleon and Chapatoulas, and just recently was taken over by another group of New Orleanians, the guys that make up Galactic.
Absolutely.
The band,
and really doing some great things.
Those
guys, we're so happy that they took that over and hope they they weather this storm.
Yeah, me too. So let's talk a little bit about you, Jess, and Lula. When did you guys open?
We just made 3 years, February 13th.
So I should know the address because I've been there plenty. It's down on St. Charles Avenue.
1532 St. Charles.
1532, prime spot for Mardi Gras.
Absolutely.
Which is probably part of the reason we're in the spot we're in right now in New Orleans and COVID-19. We just had 1.5 million people hanging out close to each other and sharing lots of food and drink. You guys are really unique in the sense that you have really fine dining at affordable prices, I would point out, but really fine dining paired with the distillery.
Sure.
And that's pretty unique, right?
Yeah, so I started off in the restaurant business and had really no aspirations of ever owning a distillery. I mean, I guess everybody, it crosses their mind at some point that, man, that would be really cool to just have a still and play around with making some rum. For me, growing up, I actually thought that would be the easiest thing to make.
In hindsight,
it turns out that's the it's the one that requires the most finesse.
Absolutely, I would say it's probably the hardest spirit we make here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. But I went on my business partner Bear Caffrey. He is he runs the LSU emergency room department at LSU, so he recruits all the mm-hmm. docs mm-hmm. there and trains them. So he was just out of medical school. I did not know him at the time. He moved to New Zealand with his wife at the time, and I took a trip with some friends. We had lived in Birmingham after Katrina, and moved down there, and that's the first time I had ever met him. And so it was on the South Island of New Zealand where distilling is legal. Mm-hmm. So you can buy the stuff, you can distill it. And he had just found out that he was a severe celiac. And, you know, we just got to talking about, you know, I've got a, you know, I want to open a restaurant one day, so on and so forth. And he's like, well, you know, why don't we look at a distillery? I'd love to make, I'd love to make liquor with you. And so we did a couple practical courses, and as I'm sure Sal can attest, the economics are difficult. I mean, mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. They're no more difficult than restaurants. I just had more confidence that I knew how to run a restaurant.
Sure, sure.
And I had less confidence that I could just do a distillery.
Right. I get panic attacks thinking about running a restaurant.
Yeah.
And I grew up in that business. My family had a restaurant, Teddy's Grill, on mm-hmm. Franklin Avenue for 36 years. Yeah, and that's stressful. I can't imagine combining the two.
Yeah, so especially when it doesn't exist in Louisiana
right.
at the time. So, you know, we had got some investors together, got some money together, and found out that it was illegal to have both in the same building. From that point, kind of started the process of getting a law change in Louisiana, which was, again, super stressful. It's one of those things where every 1 or 2 weeks there was a point where if one person says no, it's over.
Right.
As stressful as that was, it definitely, you know, for times like this, it teaches you, you need to just, you know, step back, even though it feels like you're about to pass out from panic attacks. You know, you need to take a step back and say, okay, this is going to work out. We're going to make it work out. I think that, Sal would tell you the same thing, that it's, I feel so fortunate in the restaurant business to have this to fall back on. And I'm sure he feels the same way, in the distillery, that there is if there's somewhat of a silver lining for the distilling industry in particular, is that, you know, we have the opportunity here not only to help, but, you know, to function as a business still.
Sure.
And keep our employees working.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And to keep our employees working.
Yeah, I think there's so many, like, magnitudes of order there, right? When you,
of course.
When you look at the impact on big businesses, but little mom-and-pop businesses, you know, you not only have the business owners, but the employees and the suppliers and that whole distribution chain. People just don't think about it at first glance.
It is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So if we can transition just a little bit, and we're going to get to the hand sanitizer, but let's talk a little bit for people that maybe don't know, and I'm sure we could spend hours on this, but what goes into the process of distillation? What does that mean? And because then we'll tie that into the hand sanitizer.
Let me just back up just a second,
because
I'm going to give Jess and Bear their props. So we talked about being late to the game in distilling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were trailblazers with that law that they passed that helped open up selling on premise. Which is the only way you can get off the ground is to have your in-house sales, because your margins are really slim on the store shelf. You know, when people see a price on the store shelf, you know, we're only getting a fraction of that.
Right.
So there's a middleman by law. And so they really help open up the law, and really is why you're seeing a lot of us pop open.
And maybe we should talk about that for a minute, the law, and especially since you're an attorney. I'm not an expert on it, but I would imagine, and you guys correct me, for a long time, when you look at beer laws and craft beer laws, you couldn't sell takeaway on premise, right? And there were all these rules. And I would imagine that's exactly what you ran into, that law was, those laws were adjusted as the craft beer scene and the microbrew scene came on, but nobody thought about distilling. Is that fair?
It's in the ballpark? Fair. And it's a lot of loud voices,
a lot of politics,
and we're not done by any measure of wanting to change some of these laws. I mean, the three-tier system, for your audience who is not familiar with that. So, a manufacturer has to sell to a distributor, who then sells to retail. You can't have a company with any two of those licenses. It's a holdover from Prohibition, and what we're really pushing is to either get rid of the three-tier system or lessen it. Of course, you know, we love our distributor, our Distributors Republic. And I certainly don't want to distribute my own product, to be honest, because it's a logistics nightmare. But there is a push to have the small guys be able to self-distribute.
Sure.
Jess's license combines retail and manufacturing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an and I think Louisiana is kind of on the forefront of that, thanks to these guys. So there is a blending of that, a little moving away of from the Prohibition era. So I think that's a great thing. It makes it easier to enter the market, and the more people in the market, more variety for the consumer, and it's ultimately, you know, better for them.
Well, and I think getting back to Lula, one of the things that's really neat is that you can sit there and have great food and see the distillery.
Sure.
You know, much like you can in a lot of craft brew pubs and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, Lula's the only place. It's the only place I've ever been where you can see that.
Yeah. So in Louisiana, we are the only place. But one of the main sources that we got inspiration from was in Park City, Utah. Yeah, it's a High West distillery. Mm-hmm. Yep, and they're right at the bottom of the ski slope. Barry and I went there, kind of same situation. You can see yep. From the dining room, and it's just, that was kind of a light bulb moment of, you know, wow, I already know how to run a restaurant. I already know how to run a high volume restaurant. How can we put these two together? Obviously, we don't distribute, as part of our permit, but, it allows us to take to sell a pretty large volume of our spirits, mm-hmm. Direct to the consumer without going through, which I think is for us, it's hugely important for the way that we run our business. And from my perspective, just like he said, you know, the more people that are in the game and the more people that are, showing people that, you know, small batch and taking care. I mean, if you're doing all of that, if you're not, you know, like if you're putting in the work, if you're like, you should just be able to get it out there.
Right.
I mean, you're not, yeah. You know, you're not just put a, I mean, from my perspective, I always ask, just put a case limit on me.
Sure.
Yeah, put a case limit.
Yeah, right.
If you want it to be something low, make it low. And then, you know, if that many people get into it and you feel like it's hindering you, then we can have another conversation, but just put some sort of case limit. I don't think anybody in the city, as we sit right now, is looking to do 100,000 cases,
right,
or 200,000 cases and hurt the people who are distributing Tito's or Kettle One or anything like that.
And I think you saw that, and you do see that in the brewing industry, right? Mm-hmm. With the same complaints and the volume. You're a restaurant and a distillery, right?
It's sure.
It's not like you have this huge manufacturing plant, behind you. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's almost like a meta version of farm to table, mm-hmm. because you guys do focus a lot on fresh and local ingredients,
sure.
in your menu. But then you can also see, and I think much like coming into 7-3, when you can personalize it and people can really see it, and not only get to understand the process, but get to meet the people involved.
Sure.
That's the differentiator to me, right?
Yeah.
Because maybe you guys will disagree, but just as a consumer, if you're drinking a straight vodka, there's not, with no flavoring, right? Well, by definition, there's not a lot of differentiation. Mm. But that story is what makes it unique,
sure.
and what makes someone say in New Orleans say, well, I want to buy a product from Lula, or I want to buy a product from 7-3.
Of course.
And I think the more that you can expose people to that, and hell, that's what the whole podcast is about, is exposing people to things that are unique to New Orleans, or that maybe are found elsewhere, but there's a unique twist to it, right?
Sure.
I mean, we are drinking some delicious 100-proof bourbon, I might add, but...
very soft, by the way.
Yes.
Really.
Yeah,
good.
So that's... And another thing, so the smaller guys are wanting to make things differently. I'm mm-hmm. not going to try to beat Maker's Mark at their game. They've perfected
sure.
it. So our bourbon is actually Louisiana wheat, Louisiana corn. The only thing that's not from Louisiana is a small amount of malted wheat, which is unique. Most mm-hmm. Most bourbons are 51% or more corn, either rye or wheat, and then malted barley. Ours... I like the softer wheat palates, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Eric Morningstar, who is the star of our distillery, he came up with the idea of using the malted wheat, and then we put it in a barrel at 100 proof, which is how we discovered aging. They were making bourbon and putting in these barrels just for transportation. They were putting it in about 100, and by the time it got down the river, it was actually tremendously better than when it started. So that's only 2 years and 7 months. Ask any whiskey connoisseur or maker, It is very, very difficult to make a drinkable bourbon in under 3 to 5 years. I don't know about you guys, but I think they knocked it out.
For 100 proof that, I mean, it's not hot on the front end. It's not hot on the back end.
It's got a sweetness and a mellowness to it, even at 100. Yep. So I am by no means an expert, but one of the perks of being a podcast host is that I usually hang out at the Bourbon Festival with a media pass, yeah, which means that the guys there pull out the reserve stuff, right? And this really does. It's smooth for being 100 proof.
We were actually going to dump our first barrel for that for the Bourbon Fest. Unfortunately, it got canceled. But
it's one of the real perks of being a podcaster, I got to tell you. But so let's get back a little bit. Just maybe... Distillation 101 for folks so that we can then sort of talk about why that makes sense to be able to help like you guys are doing. So kind of, again, real high level, what is the process? That's such a ridiculous question because I know it's more complex than we can possibly explain, but how do we go from raw product to something that's consumable?
So I'll give you the quick version. So anything that has any kind of starch that can be broken into sugar or sugar, you don't have to break it down for rum or molasses. So for instance, for the bourbon, we get the whole grains in locally, other than the malted wheat, and then we mill it into a powder. So most small guys do what's called grain on mashing, means we grind the grains into a powder. The grains stay in the process the entire time throughout distillation. You get more extraction, and by the time you're done, there is nothing left usable in there. So grain off is like your scotches. You just crack the grain. Mm-hmm. You're probably only extracting maybe 65% of the starches. Then they take those grains and they sell to farms or whatever because there's still nutrition there.
Sure.
Ours is completely spent at the end of the day. So you mill it. And then you basically boil it to different temperatures for different grains. What that does is your starches, the connections to your starches get really expanded and just want to break. Then you drop it down to about 145 degrees. You add your enzymes or your malt. And instantaneously, you have liquefaction, saccharification. All that starch just immediately turns to sugar. And it's like the best cereal you've ever had if you taste that. And so then we drop it down again to about 90 degrees. We put in our fermentation tanks. We add our yeast. Yeast eats sugar, and that creates alcohol. After it's fermented, then we move it to the still, and you're extracting the alcohol from the water. And then for anything going in the barrel, it goes from there to the barrel, and anywhere from 2.5 years maybe to 5 years, you'll have a finished whiskey. Rums. You skip the whole mashing thing because you already have sugar. You just heat it up. Some people boil it. I don't know what Lula does. We don't. We use all grade A molasses, so it's the first run through the mill. Mm-hmm. Hard to get. I think Lula Mill has worked with us. I forget. We get sugar anywhere we can.
That's the mill that we visited.
Yeah. And so the grade A, they don't even extract that normally,
right?
But they're very accommodating.
Yeah, they have a valve mid mm-hmm. process, and it tastes like candy. I mean, it actually tastes like pralines.
Yeah, it's amazing.
With no nuts.
That was the point in the tour that my kids got interested because they pulled some off, right? And they put some under the microscope too, so uh-huh. they could see the molecular structure.
So you're going to have the most sugar there, so mm-hmm. You're going to have the most fermentables in there. Mm-hmm. And then you just run it through the still. So I know you were talking about that process and how it lends itself to sanitizer. So we're about to implement just straight sugar, not molasses, just straight sugar, this stuff called turbo yeast. And it doesn't make a very drinkable product, but you're not drinking this, right? So we're about to implement that. We also can source these big manufacturers that make neutral spirit. So you can source that. So the demand for sanitizer is unreal and it's insatiable. And we have hospitals and government and everybody's calling us. And so Jess and I have been working together. We're sharing resources. The guild is working with one another. just trying to source as much of this stuff as we can, and following the FDA recipe that has for now a 4-week moratorium on the type of license you're supposed to have. So all of us manufacturers, they're just asking us all to make whatever we can. So, I mean, we spend all day long. I mean, I'm texting, emailing, phone calls simultaneously right now, trying to source everything from ethyl to isopropyl to bottles to peroxide to glycerin, while fielding just pleas for this stuff.
So explain, explain what's the difference of what goes into the still or into the process in order to get hand sanitizer as opposed to what's drinkable?
There's really nothing. He's saying by using turbo yeast and straight sugar. Yeah.
Is it wouldn't taste good.
It's just flavor profile. That's okay. It. Yeah. ABV is the ABV is what you're looking. The alcohol by volume is what you're looking for. And to get it to the right level, I think we have a different type of still. Similar, but
yeah.
I have a few more. Columns.
Sure.
Yeah, they can make an actual neutral. We can't. Mm-hmm. We actually blend our vodka.
Mm-hmm.
We focus on other products.
Right.
So we actually source neutral spirits from two different neutral spirits, and we blend it. And we have a filtering mm-hmm. process. So we have a little bit of a leg up on being able to get some of the neutral. As right now, if you're not a customer, they're not.
Because that's the issue, right? I mean, making it is not hard. It's getting the raw ingredients.
Yeah, yeah. Making enough. I mean, yeah, if we had, if you could snap your fingers and triple the size of your still, it would be.
Sure.
Or quadruple or.
Yeah.
Yeah. So right now for the demand, it just makes more sense. I mean, we're talking stills the size of our entire building that produce this stuff. And so to meet this demand, we're focusing on that. And yes, some of the neutrals that we're using for this will make really good vodkas. but right now, as much as we all love vodka, sanitizer is more important.
Yeah.
And so how much sanitizer are you guys able to make right now?
That's a really good question. Right now we are,
I think there are probably a few limiting factors as to how much you can make. I mean, it's a very easy process. There's just a couple of ingredients.
Sure.
It's glycerol or glycerin, mm-hmm. High proof alcohol, hydrogen peroxide, and what's the fourth? Water, huh?
Glycerin, ethyl and or isopropyl. Uh-huh. Hydrogen peroxide and glycerin. That's it.
Yeah. So as much as you can get your hands on, you can make. All you're really doing is combining them.
Sure.
Stirring them up and that's it. I mean, it's a.
And then you need a different kind of packaging.
Exactly, and that's that is I think very quickly,
an Avery label literally right here on our 4-ounce bottle. So yeah. our design team is Tilt out of Baton Rouge, and they're working on making us some little more professional labels. But you know, we just want to get it in the hands of people as soon as we can. I think both Jess and I right now are only giving it to our customers, mm-hmm. But we're doing everything we can to fulfill orders for first responders. First of all, we got a small order out to them today,
mm-hmm.
And hospitals, obviously, in the state. We're turning over every stone, calling in every favor.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said about trying to start a new business in 4 days.
Yes, exactly.
As strange as it sounds, you kind of bypass the permitting, but it is a eyes open, eyes closed, dialing, emailing, begging people for people that they know to get in touch with them to say, hey, I'm here. What do you have to offer me?
Yep.
It's something that I don't, I mean, I've never had to beg and plead and steal, not steal, but beg and plead so much of my so
I
much
plead
of
the
life.
Fifth on whether or not I would steal.
Right.
But it has been a pretty wild 4 days, and to look back and think that it's only been 4 or 5 days,
right,
is just unbelievable.
Well, honestly, until you just said that, I felt like it was 2 weeks.
Agreed.
We were talking before you got here, Jess, before we turned on the mics, that in some sense it feels like those first days after Katrina. Except that the difference is Katrina had come and gone, and as bad as it was, when we came back, you could start. It was every day was a day forward, And right now we're still in the middle of it, and we have no forecast really as to when this ends. But I think one of the reasons I was excited to talk to you guys, besides to talk about your great businesses, is that idea of small business and just being able to turn on a dime, not easily, but turn, and you have people working. So you got people working and helping and trying to help the public good. And at first glance, someone might not think, now, someone that knows about distillation would clearly understand. But there are many businesses like you all, not only in the city, but all over the country and all over the world, trying to say, what do we do? What do we manufacture? What is our skill set that we can turn into helping the common good? And to me, that's why it was so interesting to try to talk to you guys now. I know you're exhausted, and I appreciate that. But you're right. 4 days, 5 days, you've gone into a whole different industry.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I told Sal on the phone the other day, I don't really think I can imagine not starting a hand sanitizer business after
all this effort.
Yeah.
I've been saying, you know, it's a wartime effort. I mean, mm-hmm. I just heard GE General Motors, I'm sorry, not GE, is mm-hmm. going to be making respirators, and I guess not everybody is familiar, but you know, wartime effort. You had Ford, who was making like planes every, I don't know, 18 hours or something. It's something crazy,
right.
And that's how we're looking at this. Is first and foremost, you know, right around me is our employees, and Jess is committed to trying to keep his employees working mm-hmm. as well. And first and foremost, I want to do that. And this sanitizer opportunity and need is something that we can keep them working and fulfill something that's in desperate need right
sure.
now.
Sure. The other thing I was thinking about as I was driving over here is almost between your business, Jess, and your business, Sal, were a couple of spots where Andrew Higgins built the boats, mm-hmm. built the landing craft. There were a couple sites. One was very, very close to your spot, Jess, but another was right down the railroad tracks here. And that was kind of, now Andrew Higgins was very much an opportunist and was a successful businessman, but almost overnight, and I forget the street, it was a street 2 blocks from your place, I think, where they basically commandeered the street and made the first manufacturing plant on the street. World War II Museum has some pictures of it where they just said, this street where you live, we're now, like, we're building it. Boats. They come in on one side and they come out on the other side. And in many ways, I think it's a very similar thing. Higgins looked up and certainly saw a business opportunity, but also saw an opportunity to help. And it just turned into, you know, he was the largest manufacturer of ships. And I think MacArthur said, you know, he played the biggest part in winning the war. But it's that kind of thing of being able to say, what skill do I bring? And how do I turn that? And again, you mentioned being able to continue to employ your folks. And I know at least yesterday, I don't know if you still are, Jess, you guys were offering food to go. You could call in and pick it up at the street right there. I saw you had your sort of Mardi Gras stands back up, which just came down a couple weeks ago. So if you are in New Orleans and you're clearly obeying the mayor's orders but need some takeout, Lula. Sure. You guys are still doing that as of today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We've got some family meals where it's fees for $40.
Yeah.
We have a reduced price, reduced size menu that we're doing. And we're giving hand sanitizer away for right now with every order. And I have to say, from that standpoint, that's kind of been a boost, a morale boost for us as well, because you know, you the outlook those first couple of days when nobody's coming out. Nobody's eating. Everybody's just trying to go to the store, spend all their money, get the essentials they need for their house, and then you got to look at that pantry full of food, and you're like, I can't justify going out to eat. So that's slowly, probably I would say about 8-10% every day increases. It's plateaued a little bit, but we're where we need to be just with the restaurant and what we're doing to keep those. To keep the employees working, that I have a core staff of managers that we're uh-huh. that we have kept on, and just a few kitchen employees to help out in the kitchen. I think with this hand sanitizer deal, for me, the biggest thing that I basically had to let go about 55 people off of my staff, which is tough. The hope and the morale boost that it's given me overall, even. Is that this has the potential to at least give them something, you know.
Sure.
Give them some, you know, it's not just about the money. It's about, you know, as an essential business, them being able to go in and say, hey, I'm going into work. I'm going to, you know, mm-hmm. I'm the same way that we feel.
Right.
You know, like if they just shut you down completely,
right.
You just kind of mope around and you know, you just, it is so important to me to be able to get up every day and actually go into work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's definitely been a huge deal for us.
Well, I know a lot of people were probably concerned about getting food to go. Because we didn't know anything about this. I was listening to Dr. Sanjay Gupta, mm-hmm. Who he and his family are ordering food. It is not a foodborne virus, so mm-hmm. food is good. And he's just careful with the, you know, the packaging and the outside. So.
Right.
Hopefully if people start, you know, getting more information and, sure. and realizing it's yeah. safe, it'll help as well.
Yeah, cool. Well, I mean, I think we're a community, we're social, you know, we're just,
yeah.
That's just what we are. We're a social community. And it's just, I think as time goes on, people get more and more antsy mm-hmm. and
sure.
Whether it's just going to be about the ride in the car more
Absolutely.
Than anything.
Yeah. Well, and I think our take on it as a family is so many people are affected and can't do it. Right. Can't support. Maybe they were a part of that infrastructure. Maybe they were servers and producers and distributors. And we feel an obligation that we're fortunate enough to be able to do it. Now, we grew up in a restaurant business and a restaurant family. And so we see it as an opportunity to go buy food and over tip. And knowing that it's not only keeping that business going, it's maybe putting some dollars in the pockets of the employees there. But probably more important is hopefully helping keep that business going.
Mm-hmm.
So that when we do get back to normal, it's not only putting money in people's hands now, it's preserving their opportunity to earn money going forward.
Absolutely. And for any of our customers listening, they have been extremely generous to our staff with the tips.
Same here.
They're yeah. coming in extremely supportive. You know, we're giving away bottles of sanitizer, and then we're selling. Right now we have a limited amount you can buy because we're low on bottles, but soon that limit will be off. And our customers have been amazing.
Well, I'm going to put the show notes for today will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/110. Is it the 100? Yep, 110. I'll put links to Lula and to 7-3. When life returns to normal, I'm going to put you guys on the spot. We have a big Beyond Bourbon Street community. We're going to host a dinner over at Lula, and we're going to do a separate event over here.
So
people can get we'll do a private tour, and we'll do let people get to check it out. And in the meantime, we'll put links so that if you're in town, you can stop by and support these businesses. But I just want to thank both of you, Jess and Sal, for doing what you're doing. And you mentioned something early on that I think people don't think about. Sometimes people think businesses in the same industry are competitors. And on some sense, you are. But we learned a long time ago. We had a restaurant right next to a place called Kaz's Po' Boy Bakery and a third business open, another po' boy place. And my dad was very nervous. And what we quickly realized is businesses that work together and try to be good for the community end up being good for all, right? It
Absolutely.
Really does that idea of rising ships because people come and say, well, there's an industry. I'm thinking about the barbecue places here in New Orleans. There was no barbecue place, right?
Yeah, now
there's
tons
enough.
Of great barbecue, yeah.
And so you can come, you can do the same thing with coffee. Now you can do the same thing with distilled spirits. That ends up in most cases being better for the community and for the proprietors, at least in my experience.
Yeah. Absolutely. I know that's Jess's attitude. That is definitely our attitude. And we all, you know, fill a little bit of a different niche. And when you're talking about craft, it's all different. And we work together to bring the ADI conference here. Unfortunately, got canceled because of this. But that just goes to show when you work
right.
together how it can help everybody.
Well, and even I reached out to Tristan, who connected me with you, Sal, and you on your own said, hey, I'm going to bring Jess in from Lula,
yeah.
right? Again, I really appreciate what you guys are doing for the community. I appreciate you taking time. I could see it. You're both exhausted. thank you so much.
It's a much better exhaustion
yeah.
than it is. I mean, it is for me right now a very hopeful exhaustion.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right? Just like when you're opening your business.
Yeah.
You're nervous. You're right. putting out, but especially for this, it's for such a good, it's for such a good reason. And and especially, you know, the employees, the people that are going to be getting the sanitizer that need it and that want it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, it's so worth the exhaustion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And thanks for doing this and getting the word out. And yeah, we're going to stay working.
I should also mention we're at a more or less socially approved distance. We're drinking 100 proof bourbon right out of the barrel.
And plenty of sanitizer all over.
Thanks, guys, so much for joining me. Thank you all for listening. I hope this gives you a little bit of insight and also maybe a little bit of relief of what's going on.
New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you do.
Again, our sponsors that are on hiatus, Liz Wood, Two Chicks Walking Tours, and Old 77, please keep them in mind when you do get to come back to New Orleans. And until next time,
laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.